Hey, Bob, how are you this afternoon?
Hey, I'm doing fine. It's nice and sunny, and heading to 80 here, so we're happy.
Wow. Could you send some of that our way?
Yeah, I'd love to. I'm sorry. This is a big thing for us, though. I mean, I'm happy to say, but yeah, I'd be happy to support it up if I could.
Appreciate that very much. Well, here we go. We'll roll right into it here. And Bob, let's start off. Are you absolutely captivated on the edge of your seat by coverage of the NFL draft?
Well, I was at Fenway last night, and you know, but I caught up on the news, and when I first got the message on my phone that Mitch Trubisky had gone second, I must say I did arch a metaphorical as well as literal eyebrow. I did not see that coming, and I thought it was highly amusing. And correct me if I'm wrong, there is probably about a trillion words that have been spoken or written in the last 2 months about the NFL draft and the run-up to it. I don't remember any of them suggesting that the Bears would wind up with Mitch Trubisky, do you?
Well, no, and apparently from what I saw in the highlights, the Bears fans felt that way, too.
They're not happy. And now we find out today, most recently, that John Fox is telling people that he didn't know about it until 2 hours before the draft, which I find stunning. I can say that would not have happened with the New England Patriots.
I know, not at all. And maybe it'll find a way and produce a way for Jay Cutler to actually be more popular. Imagine that.
Well, I think he may have gone up, but only a notch. I think people will restrain themselves when they start thinking about the fact that they spent all these years focusing on Jay's foibles. But this is a stunning move and a very surprising one. And a couple of contexts. One is that they just invested a lot of money, and not long-term, but a lot of short-term money in Mike Glennon. And two, that if you look at what Ryan Pace, the general manager, has been saying over the months, this is not the fit. This selection does not fit the mold. He was talking about experience. He was talking about and 13 games doesn't constitute a great deal of experience. So seems to be a bit contradictory. I'm just wondering when this epiphany came that Mitch Trubisky was going to be the guy.
Well, let's talk a little baseball here. Interesting situation over the last week, the whole situation, the dust-up between the Red Sox and the Baltimore Orioles and Dustin Pedroia, right in the middle of that, taking heat from some folks and support from others. Have those ancient unwritten rules of baseball changed when it comes to throwing at people's heads?
They shouldn't. I don't believe so. I think everyone still agrees that throwing at the head is not the way is taboo. Throwing behind people in general is not good, but throwing behind people around the midsection is still one thing, and throwing behind people behind the head is quite another. I don't get the whole thing in this particular case. Well, Barnes doesn't seem like the catcher was set up outside. Barnes doesn't seem like the kind of young man who is a headhunter. He's got no record, no track record. But the whole thing. Look, Rich, the whole business of baseball etiquette drives me crazy, whether it's the retaliation and beanball wars of baseball or whether it's, you can't strut around the bases and or whatever are the taboos. I find them amusing. And in this case, though, someone could have gotten hurt. They should have taken care of it in the traditional baseball way and gone after him immediately, thrown and hit him in the first day after. He would have known. They would have known. I think Machado would have gone to first base. Buck's an old-school guy, Showalter. He would have known what was going on. It would have been over. But to wait until the last at-bat of the weekend series in the 6-2 game and then throw behind his head, that somehow seemed like it was out of that's off script. And then what happened with Pedroia mouthing, "It's not me, it's them," and all, and then the revelation of the bromance between Pedroia and Machado and the texting, and then Pedroia having to explain himself to his teammates and them having to defend him, and all this needless stuff that has been taken care of the right way, in baseball's way of doing things, we wouldn't have had all this problem on Sunday.
Bob, you were there last night. Another great outing from Chris Sale. Eventually, they'll score some runs when he's on the mound. But is this, it'll never reach, I don't think, the heights that it did with Pedro. But are his starts becoming those circle the calendar events for Red Sox fans?
Let me just, before we get to that, say that I would have, were I writing today, I would have focused equally or more on what Tanaka did. Mm. That was a three-hit shutout in which he threw 97 pitches and in which he walked nobody. And I wasn't covering the game, I would have known and be able to tell people how many three-ball counts he had. I think in my mind's eye, there were three, no more than that. And great pitching performances deserve much more attention in the Globe than and then Leeson and Herald than did Sale. Now, answer your question. It's getting there. He's been spectacular. He's been everything he's supposed to be, but he doesn't have the W's to show for it. And but his pitching, you cannot ask, reasonably ask of any man to pitch better than he has. He didn't pitch as well as Tanaka last night. He gave up legitimate runs. The first one was kind of, you know, tainted, but he gave up a hit, and then he didn't make a play, couldn't make a play on a comebacker. The ball's hit hard. It would have been a 1-6-3, but so the runner's in second, and then there was that one pitch that got away. I don't even know that they scored that a wild pitch or a pass ball. I never did find out. And the runner got to third. And then what a great at-bat by Matt Holliday. Remember?
Mm.
Oh, that was a 9 or 10 pitch at-bat. Once again, if I were covering, I would know. But and then he lined a hard liner to left for the sacrifice fly. And then, of course, the two runs in the ninth. But, yeah, Sale's been great. And certainly he's been worth the money.
Speaking of pitchers, you had a chance to talk with Jim Lomborg on your podcast recently, and we'll talk about that 67 season a lot in honor of this 50th anniversary, but it's impossible to overstate what that season did for baseball in Boston and really all of New England.
It is impossible, and that's not an abuse of the English language. I keep saying that the current administration, who have benefited so mightily and who have got a $1 billion-plus franchise now on their hands and who have done well by themselves and done well by the fans as everything else we all know. But they could never thank Yastrzemski, Lomborg, Petrocelli, all the living guys, and then the memory of Dick Williams and Dick O'Connell, et cetera. They could never thank those guys enough for what they did, because that is the dividing line in Red Sox history. And in 1965, they drew 650-some-odd thousand people. In 1966, they drew 811,142 people. and that is, in 65, that's 2.5 homestands now. And that's where we've come. And they changed everything. Everything. They restored interest in the sport. You know, Fenway wasn't revered in 1967 when the season started. It was like the old sofa at Grandma's house. Tom Yawkey wanted to get out of there. He was on record. You go look up a story that was in the Sporting News written by Larry Claflin in June of 1967 about quoting extensively Tom Yawkey about how badly he wants to get out of Fenway Park. It's had its day. Can't do business there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's how far we have come. Yes, that was the utter dividing line in Red Sox history.
We're talking with Bob Ryan here on Downtown. Speaking of the podcast, a great guest today. I have to say your podcast is absolutely a must listen. It is so good, and I can't wait when I get home to listen to you talk with Hubie Brown.
Oh, I think you'll enjoy Hubie, because this is a Hubie that the fans don't get to hear. They get Hubie in sound bites because he's a color man. But anyone who's ever gone to a clinic or heard Hubie speak knows what he's really like and how amazing he really is as a speaker. And he gets a chance to stretch his vocal legs here with me in a way that people don't ordinarily get to hear. So and we go back to 1972, when he entered the NBA as an assistant coach with Larry Costello on the Bucks. It was his entry into professional basketball after having been assistant coach at Duke for a number of years, where, by the way, one of his colleagues in the beginning was Chuck Daly, and that they were working for the great Vic Bubas. But I go back with Hubie, so we have a good rapport, and I think anyone who likes basketball, in all immodesty, I say I think this is a real treat for them. I think they're going to enjoy it.
Boston Celtics tonight have a chance to wrap up that first-round series. How important is it for Brad Stevens to get that tiny monkey off his back of not winning a playoff series?
No, it's not tiny. If they do not win this series, it'll be a gorilla entering next year. It'll be year four. They would have had incremental improvement up to 52-3 wins. So number one seed, as bogus as it was a number one seed. And even if it had been two, that would have been a fine thing to have. And they have to win. They must win this series. And I hope they get the job done and don't bring all the pressure on themselves to win a home game on Sunday. But I think they would. But I'd like to see them get the pressure off and have a few days and get ready to next round, because the next round is going to be very difficult. I didn't care who they were going to play. In fact, it wouldn't matter to me whether they were going to play Toronto, Washington, or Atlanta. I think they will have trouble with any of them. They had to have. This is a must-have. And then I think it's all house money for me. Now, maybe not for everybody else. Maybe the expectations were unnecessarily raised by having a one seed. I hope people understood what that meant and what didn't mean. But at minimum, they had to win a series. So, yes, he must.
It's certainly been remarkable what Isaiah Thomas has been able to do, given everything he's been through over the last couple of weeks.
It's been tough. I mean, on the eve of the playoffs, he loses his sister in that tragic accident, and he's held up so well. But he's not himself 100% yet. He's not shooting well. His 3-point percentage is down. Anything that he can't do is understandable. But he's a great little competitor and a wonderful player. And our heart goes out to him. Anybody that has lost a family member prematurely will tell you. It's very, very difficult. So yeah, but he is he's an asset. I never dreamed he was this good, and I don't think anybody did, including and especially the two teams that gave him up. I don't think they ever dreamed he would turn into this kind of player. What I'm hoping for is to see him make at least third team All-League this year, if not second. And, I might be asking too much for second. We know the first team guards are going to be Harden and Westbrook, and we know that Curry's still out there, and maybe Chris Paul. But I'm hoping that he can at least make third team All-League. I think it'd be a worthy tribute to the season that he had.
I have to tell you, Bob, I smiled when I saw you mention one of my favorite songs from the rock and roll era and one of the most unique artists, a salute to the great Screamin' Jay Hawkins, and I Put a Spell on You.
Oh, my God. That song is so classically, crazy, offbeat, great Screamin' Jay. I was introduced to that song. I don't know exactly when it came out. I could go Google it and find out. But when I got to Boston in 1964 as a freshman, we had an all-time first ballot Hall of Fame disc jockey named Bruce Bradley on WBZ, and he was on at midnight at 8 o'clock, the midnight shift, and he used to play the snippet, the part where you go, "I don't care if you don't want me, I'm yours right now," and he used to play that coming out of breaks, or play that to punctuate things, as a snippet, and then he would play the song sometime during the evening, and that's how I discovered that song. I know other people have done it. People tell me about other covers, including a female cover, and all due respect, come on. No way. First of all, a woman shouldn't go near that song. Really. And secondly, stop it. Hold all calls. We have a winner. You can't do a song, and put a stamp on it any more than he put his stamp on I Put a Spell on You.
And when he would do it live, he would come on stage in a coffin.
I know, it's great. I wish I had seen that. I was aware of that, and I know. But so I hope people, they got to go find it. It is spectacular.
No question about it.
I couldn't believe it when I heard it. I'm a Sirius guy, and when I heard it on Sirius that day, I said, "Well, my day's made. The rest of this day's downhill."
And you also had a shout out to maybe the earliest song I remember singing as a tiny, tiny child, Lonnie Donegan's "Does Your Chewing Gum Lose Its Flavor on the Bedpost Overnight."
On a short list of songs, if I had to have a list, which would include anything, Sinatra, symphonies, doesn't matter. Those two songs would be on a list of at least 25 for me, if not even 10. And the Lonnie Donegan thing, how can you not like it? How can you not like it? The music, I love the skiffle sound. And the lyrics are priceless. And if they make tin whistles out of tin, what do they make foghorns out of? Boom, boom! Oh, come on! It is just the greatest. And then it's alive. It's recorded live. That's not phony, baloney. Addendum at the end. That's a real orchestra. I find this out. It was recorded live, and it's just fantastic. And the two of them within a 24-hour period. That certainly was a great boost for me.
Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe. Check out Bob Ryan's podcast as well, available everywhere. Bob, always a treat for us. Thanks for visiting with us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Jay. Bye-bye.